Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Outer Sanctum is recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respect to their elders past and present.
Good plan, good plan. Who thought of this one?
You're listening to the Outer Sanctum podcast.
Here is a moment in time in the history of the AFL.
In from the side, Houghton. She was surrounded by blue jumpers.
Welcome to the Outer Sanctum for another edition of the Fifth Quarter. My name is Kate Sear and I'm thrilled to be joined this week by my Sanctum sister Rana Hussain and Francis Oratifi. Many of you will know Francis as an on-field star, having played soccer in the old National Soccer League, as well as for clubs in the UK and, of course, the Socceroos. But it's Francis's work off the field as a lawyer and human rights advocate that we have found truly inspirational. Alongside his good friend, Craig Foster, Francis played an instrumental role in the campaign to save Hakeem El-Arabi, and he's been involved in the Matildas campaign for equal prize money at the FIFA Women's World Cup. He's also involved in advocacy in other sports, including the AFL, where he sits on Collingwood's anti-racism advisory group. And it's my great pleasure to finally welcome you, Francis, to the Outer Sanctum.
Oh, thank you very much. You're such a generous welcome. I don't think I deserve all of that, but thank you, Kate and Rana. It's wonderful to be with you.
There are many more things I could have listed from your resume today. I wonder if I can start with one of the things that you did that holds a very dear place in my heart, and that is many years ago, you were on a very sweet and quirky and I think uplifting TV show called Nerds FC. I wonder if you can tell our listeners a little bit about it and what drew you to that show, because I loved it.
Yeah, Nerds FC was a funny one. I think the first season, it was the idea behind it was to get a bunch of nerds, or what we call nerdy, really smart people. When we say nerds, I think that's a euphemism for very, very intelligent people from all sorts of spheres of life that love sport, but obviously are not athletically gifted, if you like, but love it. And so the idea was to bring these people together as a team and build a team over a period of time. And then at the end of the, I think it's the 10th week or whatever, then you get them, they get to play against a bunch of professional players. And it was just to show how everyone developed and how they, in terms of their love and joy for the game, and how much just the enthusiasm and how it changed them as people, you know, in terms of their love and passion for football. And that was the reason, the idea behind it. And in season two, I was the assistant coach to Craig Foster. It was fantastic fun to film and a joy to be a part of.
You mentioned Craig Foster there. We are all big fans of his as well. How important is that friendship for you with Craig?
Oh, look, it's sometimes I don't even think about it because it's been there for so long. I mean, Craig and I have known each other for over 30 years. I mean, we played in the same league, obviously, against each other for many years. And then we were teammates, I think, for a year at Marconi. And even before then, I was friends with him. And then I think the thing that really also kind of held us together was our involvement with the PFA. Craig was also on the executive of the PFA for many years when he played, as I was. Yeah, so we've just been on this really long journey around social justice and unions, and that kind of grew out of that. Obviously, I've gone on to do law. Craig has gone on to do law as well. Extremely smart guy, just very, very smart and really principled. So yeah, that friendship's very, very important. And I think that, for example, when we undertook the campaign for Hakeem, to that global campaign, which is a collective campaign. Yeah, that friendship was very important because of the connections that we both had.
When you both catch up for coffee, is it just massive issues, chatting over coffee, human rights issues, or can you be silly together? What's the friendship like?
Oh, we can do both. We can do both. We're still a bit silly with each other, but it's really funny. I remember a number of, it might have been about a year or two ago, we were with a group of our normal friends. David Bashir was there and we were all having coffee. I actually remember quite clearly, it was at the Trattoria in Bondi, on Bondi Beach, and we were sitting there, a whole bunch of us having a coffee, just having a laugh as usual. And Fozzie and I, at this stage, I mean, I'd finished my law degree, Fozzie was still into his, and we're talking about law. and Bash is like, what are you talking about law for? You know, this is football, you know, football stuff. And we're saying, but that was the thing. We'd completely started time to talking about law and human rights. Yeah, because our heads are just completely in that space now, even though we still love football, don't get me wrong, but, you know, it was really funny. So
is there a particular moment or something within your life that made you realise that you wanted to go and study law and become an advocate for human rights issues?
Look, like everything really. I mean, it was one of those things. I thought about it a long time ago. When I first finished playing football, I remember, for example, when I was back in the PFA and we set up the Equal Opportunity Code, because that had arisen out of my personal experiences of racism, of being racially vilified. And Brendan Schwab and the executive and Foz, and they were very supportive. And Kim Ontaliadoros was the president at the time. So if you go back, that was over 20, 25 years ago. These guys were extremely supportive. And so we were way ahead of our time in terms of the way that we're thinking progressively about racism. And so I look at stuff like that. I knew about racism, but I didn't have a language how to discuss it. I didn't know I didn't have a framework or a language, or because even though I knew and experienced it, it was difficult to actually explain it sometimes to some of those guys or people around the sport. As you know, Rana now being involved at the AFL. And imagine they're sitting there and trying to explain to somebody who's a white middle class person around the issues of whiteness, for example. You know, I had no idea about that sort of language or that sort of those sorts of things. So it's really difficult. So even though I knew what I was feeling, but I didn't know how to express it. And I think that's the thing that I got with law, that later on, when I finally decided I was going to do it, I was only in my mid-40s, and I thought, my God, going to law school, you know, and all that, and having to go through this. But in the end, I just thought, you know what, life is too short. Yeah, so I made that plunge personally to go do it, personal development, and also in terms of how I could use that later on.
So that framework that you did sort of find, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I mean, for example, when you're talking about racism, for example, for a long time, and I think for a long time now, we tend to look at racism as that it's this domain of the uneducated, the malicious, you know, that these people are just uneducated, they're malicious, they're ignorant, and that racism is just this thing, it's just slurring people, and it's just it's just vilifying individuals. And so the work I'm trying to do, and obviously that we're involved with at Collingwood, is reframing racism and saying, look, it's actually not about individuals. It's about systems. It's about structures and systems. And until you start to interrogate those structures and systems, what you're doing is that you're doing half a job. That's where the thinking is for me right now, is framing it as a systemic issue, and also the role of human rights in this, that, you know, that if we can start to sort of look at it as a question of human rights, the issue of gender discrimination, gender inequality, racism, whether it's based on the base of sexuality, sexual orientation, all those things, that if we then start to look at these things as systemic, that we will then start to really get a grasp on what the problem is and start to tackle it properly. And I think that's where, I guess where my head is, and where I'm reading a book at the moment called Talking Up to the White Woman by Professor Morton. And that stuff to me is just, it's just mind blowing. You know, you look at that stuff and you go, my God. And so it just makes you think that the more you read, actually, the less I actually know. And that's a depressing thought, because I've been thinking, I've been walking around being so ignorant about these gender issues, especially around not just women in general, but when you look at that intersection of Indigenous and women of colour as well, you think, my word, I have no idea. That's kind of the thinking at the moment that drives some of that work that I'm trying to do at the moment.
I understand that feeling, Francis, that the more you read, the less you feel you know. I know that feeling well, actually. But you know, I've followed you on Twitter for a number of years, and you're always sharing a wide range of sources and information and things that are so informative and educational, constantly doing the work. I'm wondering if there is a particular person or activist or thinker that's really been inspirational to you and to your development and thought process.
I don't know that it's actually one person as such. I think, well, actually, there is an English writer. Her name is Rennie Edo-Lodge. She wrote the book Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Racism. I mean, that was when I first started to get my head around the ideas of, for example, intersectionality and what that meant and how much of an impact that meant in terms of just not just looking at the actual discrimination in terms of gender, but also looking at it, or sex, but looking at it in terms of the intersecting inequalities as well. In Australia, I'd say that it was people like Megan Davis, some of the stuff that she's done. There's also Professor Chelsea Wadigo. I think, yeah, and when I started to look at the stuff that they were doing and the things that they were talking about, and there's another lady as well, Dr. Marlene Longbottom. And so it was through this, you know, that you start to sort of learn this stuff through them. So I guess it's more, and at the risk of embarrassing him as well, which is why I'm such a huge advocate of the framework in terms of human rights and how that can be a really important piece and a solution in terms of racism in sport and in terms of addressing human rights issues in sport, not just in terms of racism, gender, discrimination, the employment conditions of athletes, freedom of expression, the right to collectively bargain. So we're looking at the United Nations Guiding Principles and on Business as Human Rights as a framework, again, and how that can help to push and to get sports to actually respect human rights. If you have harmed people, then you have to make sure that you've got processes and procedures in place in terms of access to an effective remedy. And again, that's the sort of direction I'd like to see the AFL go in, you know, in terms of adopting, because as a sports enterprise, it has that responsibility, I believe, to respect human rights. That's the minimum expected conduct of business enterprises in terms of how they're expected to behave. So at the risk of embarrassing him, it's Brendan Schaub is another person that I've learned a lot from, especially around that. And I think sometimes when I talk to my white friends and a few of them, that it can be challenging for them when you challenge them about, I mean, like when you mention stuff like white privilege to your friends, all of a sudden, for the first time, someone like me having a chat to my friends who've been friends with me for a long time, and I challenge them about things like white privilege and whiteness, they can find that quite confronting. But it requires a level of trust and a feeling of safety and I think love, you know, for people not to feel that that it's you're accusing them and that you're labeling all white people racist. And sometimes if you're not black, if you're not a person of color, if you're not Aboriginal, we view things through a certain lens. I'm not saying all black people are monolithic and we all do that. We're not. We view things through a certain lens. And I think sometimes I'm also careful with the fact that I don't want white people to think that you're kind of saying all white people are racist and they're irredeemable, because that's not true.
Can I just ask you a bit more about those conversations, those challenging conversations you have with your white friends, Francis, and conversations that are done with this in the spirit of love and trust? Are you explicit about that, about where you're coming from in those conversations with them? Do you say to them, I'm coming to you with love and with generosity of spirit, and I want you to listen to me? Because a lot of our listeners will want to have these conversations with people and not know where to begin.
Yeah, I don't think I did it initially. I think that I just kind of said stuff. The thing is that I would then go back and say to them, look, it's not about painting a picture of white people as irredeemable racists. It's not. We're all a product of our own socialization. And I said, so, but it's about people being able to listen and being able to, and as you say, there's that empathy, being able to have that empathy, listening to people's lived experiences, you know, and we often find that in these relationships, you know, between, you know, when you talk about, when you're in spaces that are predominantly white, people actually don't realize that there is still that power imbalance. Because, I mean, for example, when we talk about inclusion and diversity, and people say, oh, we're going to include all these people in these spaces. But who's actually doing the including? There's a sense of they're the ones who are doing the including. What are you including me into? Are you including me on a basis of equality, of respect? Do we have the same amount of power? I mean, because if you're including me into this system, that means that you've got the power and you're just being benevolent to me. So it's having these conversations can be quite delicate. So you've got to, but I tend to just express it in terms of the fact that, yeah, it's been done out of love and they just need to listen. And if you listen to people like myself, who've had the experience, who've had the lived experience, because you can't ever have that experience. You might empathize with me. You might even sympathize at some of the things that I've had to go through. And as friends, they do. I know they do. That if I was to be racially vilified or suffer some sort of an injustice, I know they feel it. But it's still not the same as a person who has to go through it. And I think a lot of them now are starting to get that. And I think since it's funny, since the George Floyd thing, where some of my friends have actually approached me and said, let's have a conversation about this sort of stuff around racism, around inequality, and about racial injustice. And we've started to have some really open conversations, which is great.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Kiara Bowes and you're listening to The Outer Sanctum.
I want to ask you about the AFL because you are doing pieces of work with them. How does the AFL compare to other codes that you've worked with in terms of doing this work?
I can't say that I've worked with any other code. I only know my own code. So in terms of the work that we've done in football, I know the good thing, I'm not saying football's perfect by a long shot. We've got a lot of issues. As you would know, if you followed the European Championships in June, you saw all the issues around taking the knee and some of the response of some of the crowds and even some countries to that around the issues of LGBTQI displays of symbols of solidarity with those groups. That there were some places they were fully accepted, in other places they weren't. And we saw the problems with racism with the England players, the black England players, the three players when after the penalty shootout. However, I have to be quite honest about it. The AFL is just like, I think it's like a different universe in terms of the level of racial literacy. It's just really, really low. And the other thing that's also low is after the Adam Goods thing, everyone keeps, I mean, and I've been through this because I've been around for a bit. I remember when I was playing, the Nicky Winmar thing happened where Alan McAllister said, well, we'll respect Aboriginal players if they behave like white people. I'm paraphrasing what he said, basically. That's, you know, if they behave like white people, we'll respect them. And then we had the Michael Long, Damien Monkhorst thing. And then we had Peter Everett. And then we had, you know, so there's been a whole load of things that have happened. And then you had the Adam Goods. And many of us at the time were screaming that this was racism. The boos were being motivated by racism. But the institutions themselves, the clubs, the AFL itself, and even the players' union were reticent to sort of really confront the issue head on because they were scared of upsetting their fans. And because this whole thing around racism, again, is framed as a political issue rather than an issue of human rights, they just didn't have that courage. And I don't think, I don't think they had the understanding. And I don't think that they also had the courage as well to kind of take it face on. That's still a problem now because I think that, you know, when we've seen what's happened with the Collingwood and we saw what's happened recently with the Tex Walker, it shows that, you know, it's deeply, deeply cultural. And I said that in my statement when Eddie Maguire was asked to resign. I drafted a statement. I was one of those who was the author of the letters who drafted a statement saying, it's not about Maguire. And this isn't about Tex Walker, the individual. It's about a whole system. If that whole system wasn't built on a racial hierarchy in which there is this understanding that some people are lower in a hierarchy than others, you just wouldn't have that sort of behavior and that sort of conduct and what we've been seeing. So yeah, where the AFL is, I think they've got a long way to go. There is a willingness from the people I've spoken to. I know at Collingwood, with the directors, there is a real willingness to go on that journey. And that's the same with the Players Association as well. I think the AFL Players Association, their leadership, they know that there's a blind spot, but they're prepared to do the work. And I think that's a great starting point. I think if you're prepared to do that, I think that there is hope. And that's what keeps me involved in that, because I think that hopefully in some small way I can make a difference in trying to help the sport.
You talked about your own experience of vilification 25 years ago, and you said that you were supported well by the players' union. What was it exactly that they did that the AFL might not have done then or that you feel didn't do in the Adam Goods saga? Can you tell us what the kind of clincher is and the distinction?
Sometimes in terms of the comparisons, it's hard because the AFL as a sport, Australian rules football as a sport, is a white sport. It's predominantly male. And now I'd say quite middle class, middle upper class, you know, private school, you know, all that. they're the ones who run all the institutions. You look at the AFL Commission, you look at the AFL management, you look at the clubs in terms of their senior management positions. It's very white male upper class. It's only played in Australia. Whereas you get football, has always been an international sport. The multiculturalism is embedded within the DNA of football just because of purely the nature of the fact that it's a world game. So you've got that. So I'm not saying, and again, I'm not saying that racism doesn't exist, but on a whole, people from different backgrounds and whatnot, they get on quite well overall. So that I think coming from that sort of foundation, you don't have the journey's not as long in terms of the understanding around racism, because I think it's already there. Whereas I think with the AFL, that's what's lacking. And I think that's what needs to change. The management there and the whole of the sport, you know, needs to go on this journey in terms of understanding racism. Racism and what it is and how to make the sport more inclusive. That's a big, big journey. And I think that's a lot of, and that's difficult. And that's one of the reasons why I like to think that what I bring to the Collingwood expert group is an international dimension. As you would know, Ryan, I've talked about the work that we do on a global level in terms of respect for human rights and how that can be embedded into the governance of the sport and institutions of the AFL. The people at the very top are the ones who are going to have to change. They're going to have to lead it. And basically, that's what it comes down to. I think that's a difference for me. I think football's always had that thing there, that DNA in terms of being multicultural. I mean, you look at the history of the game here with the Italians, the Greeks, the South Americans, the Croatians. And I mean, even me, I came from England. I mean, and as an English, a young English lad growing up, I wouldn't have known the difference between a Croatian and a Serb or a Bosnian, you know, but coming to Australia, I was exposed into that melting pot. All the different religious groups automatically, we don't even bat an eyelid about diversity and the differences, if you like. Whereas I think in the AFL, to go into that environment, I think that quite often people from diverse backgrounds, from whether you're a Muslim, whether you're Europe or whatever, you have to adapt. It's got this structure of whiteness, you know, in terms of the space itself. You have to adapt, otherwise you don't survive. I mean, let me just give you a quick example about that. Somebody said, Lumumba, for example, why did he go along with the name Chimp? Why didn't he say something about it? Why didn't he? But the point is that if you have any understanding of how a high performance and a professional sporting environment works, you know, there's a lot of emphasis placed on cohesiveness, being together, on shared values. If that space is very, very white, we can see why Lumumba had a lot of problems pushing against it, because if he'd objected to it, it'd have been like, oh well, you can't take a joke, you don't have a sense of humor, and people don't realize that if you start to respond to racism and microaggressions in that manner, you don't last. They'll just spit you out, and they'll say things like, oh, he didn't fit in culturally, you know, and that sort of stuff. So this is the issue, you know, that people that are not and coming from a sporting background, someone who hopefully understands that in terms of the dynamics of how high-performance sports environment operate, that I'm able to sort of give that sort of perspective and say, no, it's not as easy as that, as just objecting, and then someone in power is going to say, hey, you know what, you're right.
I did mention at the top your work on the Matilda's Equal Pay campaign. How much is the fight for equal pay impacted by practical issues such as smaller audiences or apparent lack of public interest in watching women play sport, and how much of it is simply a product of sexism and sexist attitudes?
Oh, look, I think it's a second what you said. It's a product of sexist attitudes. And again, it's a question of how you are socialized. And I see it a lot with the AFLW is like, oh yeah, but the women's game don't generate the revenue. That's why they don't get paid that much. That's why they don't get the resources that the men have. But you say, but hang on, if the idea of sport is that everybody has a fundamental right to access sport, and if sports governing bodies, if their duty is to actually provide access to sport, why have we spent the last 100 years or whatever investing all of the resources into men's sport and barely anything for women? So I can go with women's football and say, when you look at what's happened with Women's World Cup, for example, the Women's World Cup has grown, the tournament itself, in terms of the revenues it generates, because they're investing in it, and the women are getting better and better because they're getting better facilities. They're playing professionally in some of the top leagues in Europe, mostly in Europe, and the product's getting better and better. And so commercially, that could also improve. But for me, it's about a question of equity. The women, they spend the same amount of time in training. They have the same dedication, training, sacrifices. So there's no reason why they shouldn't receive equal pay, as far as I'm concerned. So it's very difficult sometimes to have that argument, because the first thing people go to is the commercial stuff. They're not generating enough money. Well, how about you use some of the money that you're spending on the men and invest that into the women's game, you know, and then watch it grow.
Francis, I just really want to ask you, is there a personal toll to doing this work?
It costs you opportunities, I think. I think in terms of certainly within sport, I think it can do. Because, yeah, if you're pointing the finger at sports governing bodies or some of them and saying, look, you're not doing this, you're not doing that, some people don't receive that very well. Yeah, but I'm proud of the work we've done, and I'm proud of what I do. And I just also think, well, it depends on what the success means for you in life. Is it pursuing areas where you get paid the most money, or is it doing really meaningful work that's going to have an impact on people's lives and is going to change people's lives in a real impactful and positive way? And that's the thing that I get the buzz out of, in being a part of a group of people that are trying to change things for the better. And I think over the next 10 years, human rights is going to be the real big issue. And that's going to have the most impact, I think, in terms of sports for sports, not just for people who play sports, but for everyone else who's also has a relationship with sport in terms of how they experience it and how they're connected with it. And in terms of the delivery of sport and how that impacts on communities and the fans and everything else. So I think that's going to be the next big thing. And as I said, that work around human rights is really, really important. And I think we're starting to see some shift there in terms of a recognition that sports have a responsibility to respect human rights. And that if they do harm people through their activities or their relationships, that they have an obligation to actually remedy the harm and to do so through an effective process.
Yeah, I think that reorientation is definitely happening, Francis. I think you're right. And no small part due to people like you and Craig Foster and Brendan Schwab and many, many others. So thank you so much for sharing your experiences and wisdom with us today. It's been absolutely fantastic and we were so grateful to have had your time.
No, thank you very much. It's also a pleasure. And Rana, I mean, it's really great to be working with people like Rana on the Collingwood expert committee as well, because she brings so many different experiences in terms of her background as well. And so I learn from listening to people like Rana as well when on shows like yours. So thank you. And you too, Kate, of course.
That's very kind. Thanks so much, Francis. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Cheers.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.